But I would ask, who are we looking at? We're often saying, is this workshop making white people less racist? Or is this workshop changing the behavior of white leaders? But what we're not asking is, does this workshop make marginalized employees specifically feel like they're being given the tools that they need to advance and to grow and to thrive?
My name is Linda Laurel, and I'm asking you to have the courage to listen with an open mind to all of our voices, because our voices matter. Hey, everybody, it's Linda Laurel. Thanks so much for joining us for another episode of Our Voices Matter podcast. My guest today is an anti-racism educator, DEI consultant, professor, author, TEDx speaker, and podcaster. She is also one of LinkedIn's top voices in racial equity. In fact, LinkedIn is where I was first introduced to Janice Gassum Asare. She wrote an article about hair discrimination in the workplace, and it made me think long and hard about my own hair journey. We actually explore that in the Switch It Up section a little bit later in the episode toward the end. But before we get there, Janice offers her perspective and some actionable steps for leaders to consider when approaching their DEI efforts. Here now, my conversation with Dr. Janice Gassum Asare. Okay, Janice, it is so nice to see your beautiful face and to meet you for the very first time. Welcome to Our Voices Matter podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on the podcast, Linda. I'm so excited for our conversation.
So am I. And I, you know, people ask me all the time how I find my guests, and quite often I will find them on LinkedIn. And that's how I found you. I read your article, 4C Hair Discrimination, and it resonated with me on such a deep level that I instantly messaged you and said, will you please come on the podcast? I want to talk with you about this topic and other topics related to DEI and anti-racism and the work that you do as a consultant in that space and all of the many other things that you do. So let's start by having you share with our audience a little bit about what you, Janice Gassum Asare, do. Tell us about you.
Yeah, sure. So I do a few different things, but I work with organizations and institutions to help them create environments that are more equitable, that are safer, and that really focus on freeing marginalized employees from harm. And so I work with them in a consulting capacity. So I work with organizations and institutions to provide guidance for employees. And I also provide workshops and trainings around these topics, because awareness and education is one of the missing parts of creating an environment that is safe and free from harm. So I do a lot of work with workplaces to create those environments that are really built on equity.
And how did you get drawn to this work? What is it about it that that drew you to it, and why are you so passionate about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think really what it was is watching my parents, Linda, going through all of their experiences, you know, experiencing discrimination and experiencing racism and living in mostly white neighborhoods. You know, we grew up in mostly the suburbs
What part of the country did you grow up in?
So we moved around a lot. Right. So my parents were not in the military. My dad was a professor. So my dad taught at several different universities and then started teaching at different HBCUs. So I was born in Texas and we moved to Delaware. We lived in Minnesota. I spent most of I say I'm from Virginia because that's where I spent most of my time. But we also lived in the Middle East. So we've moved around a lot, but I spent many of my formative years right outside of DC. So in Northern Virginia is where we spent a lot of time. But one thing that was pretty much the same in all of these environments was that we were the only Black family there, right? So mm-hmm. we were the only Black people. And I didn't understand what racism was as a child, but I would see the expressions on my parents' face when they would come home and they would have an experience where someone treated them, harshly. And that really sort of sparked my interest in how to create an environment where people aren't feeling what it is that my parents experienced and were feeling. And I really felt like Black employees specifically have these very unique experiences, and we're not focusing on Black employees enough. And I think that there's an importance with specificity and being really intentional about studying the experiences of people who experience harm and how to, and really like strategizing how to make sure that our workplaces are more inviting and support people and allow them to thrive.
Wow. Okay. So I really want to explore all the workplace work that you're doing. But before we go there, I want to go back to your childhood and your parents experiencing discrimination and you as a young child witnessing that and seeing the effect that it had on them and you by proxy. How did your parents deal with that in terms of teaching you how to navigate in white spaces?
I think that is such a good question. And I have to also mention the added layer that my parents are immigrants. So they immigrated to the United States in the 80s. And so they struggled from Cameroon. Yeah. Wow. So it's a country right next to Nigeria. And so my mom came here. She didn't speak any English. Her first job, I feel like her first job was at Six Flags, which is an amusement park. And so she did not speak English. And so navigating, there were multiple layers. So Dubois talks about, in the book, The Souls of Black Folks, he talks about this double consciousness that Black people in America experience, right? And I felt almost like there was a triple consciousness that I was experiencing where I was trying to navigate being a young Black girl growing up in mostly white spaces with immigrant parents who didn't understand American culture. And so there were a lot of layers. And so I think that watching what it is that my parents really struggled with, which was all having to do with not feeling like they were a part of the workplaces that they were a part of. You know, I think really watching that, I didn't understand, had an effect on me. But as an adult now, I realized both of my parents were educators. And, you know, my father was teaching at predominantly white institutions. And all of the racism he experienced made him really want to surround himself with Black people and Black faces. And he started teaching at different historically Black colleges and universities. And I think he really, really loved that environment and just being around other people that looked like him and helping other people that looked like him. And, you know, I was always wondering what it was to create an environment where people didn't feel like that, where people didn't go home and they were angry and they were frustrated and they felt like, you know, it wasn't a place that they belonged. And I never knew that there was a industry that looked at and took organizational psychology and took the dynamics of the workplace into consideration. And so when I was an undergrad in college, I went to school in Virginia. And I studied psychology and I love psychology. I love the study of people and figuring people out. And after I graduated, I went into banking and I was working in banking for several years. But I was always so fascinated with like, why is it that I love the customers, but the environment here is not one in which I'm able to grow and thrive and advance? And I thought about my parents' experience and I really was interested in going into a field where I could study this in more detail. And I mm-hmm. learned about industrial organizational psychology, which is just the study of the psychology of the workplace. And that was something that sort of propelled me to start doing this work and really focusing on marginalized employees specifically.
Mm-hmm. And is that what your PhD is in?
Yeah, so exactly. So my PhD is in organizational psychology. I actually started a business. So my father teaches finance and economics, and he encouraged me to go to graduate school for that. I enrolled in an MBA program, and I actually failed out of that program because I was so good at business, law, and marketing. I love those courses, but I was not good in accounting, finance, or economics. And so after a semester and a half, I was like, this is not what I want to do. I love psychology and this is not what it is. And I started doing some research and I found this other field of psychology, which was like workplace psychology. So I became really fascinated in that. And then I decided to pursue a PhD in that.
Wow. That's wonderful. So, okay. When you get hired by a company to go into their workplace and help them address diversity, equity, inclusion, belonging, accessibility, all of that, what's the first thing that you ask them?
I love that question. I would say that the first thing that I ask them is I actually ask to talk to the employees. Because what the leaders tell me is sometimes vastly different from the perceptions of employees. And leaders will bring me in and say, we need you for X, Y, and Z. And I will say, can I have a conversation with employees, right? And some of the things that I'll ask when I do speak with employees is, do you trust the leaders in this company? Do you feel like you are safe here? Does your manager and do your team members make you feel safe on this team? Do you feel like this organization is one in which you are able to grow and to thrive and advance? And so if an employee says no to some of those, I try to probe a little deeper and ask why and what is it that's preventing you from feeling that? And so I think that those conversations can produce very rich responses that aren't often recognized by leadership. So it's so interesting because before I do any consulting work, I always ask to speak with employees to gauge where they are. Because I think even when organizations and institutions conduct surveys, surveys don't often get to the heart of the matter and help you understand what the problems are. Surveys are great because people want to see numbers. People want to know 50% of the workplace feels like they're able to grow and thrive. 70% feels like they're being paid fairly. But what the data doesn't tell you is why, right? Why is it that 70% of the employees in this workplace feel a particular way? So those conversations with employees really help to unpack and peel back those layers as far as why is it that employees feel this way, right? Mm-hmm, and even a lot of my counterparts who do this work, there's a lot of mixed feelings when it comes to DEI training, right? And I am a huge advocate for DEI education and workshops and trainings. But I think that the way we even think about them is misguided. I think oftentimes people aren't fans of them because they say they don't produce behavior change, right? But I would ask, who are we looking at? We're often saying, is this workshop making white people less racist? Or is this workshop changing the behavior of white leaders? But what we're not asking is this workshop making marginalized employees feel safer, right? Or does this workshop make marginalized employees specifically feel like they're being given the tools that they need to advance and to grow and to thrive? We don't always look at that. We just say, oh, unconscious bias training and DEI trainings are not effective, right? You look at the research, so much is put out that says these aren't effective. We should stop doing them. But I think that we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We really have to look at and ask different questions than the questions that we've been asking about that particular type of intervention.
That's so interesting. And then when you ask the question, when you ask a different question, then you're going to come at it from a different perspective, and then you're going to get a different outcome. So I love that. So what do the leaders say when you go back to them after having spoken with the employees, the Black employees, and gotten their perspective, and then you share some of that with the leaders? How do you present that information in such a way that they are going to receive it in a way that that prompts them to listen and then perhaps change their leadership style based upon what it is you're saying? Because that's got to be a very delicate kind of conversation, I would imagine.
Yeah, what I think is the benefit to when I come into these workplaces is that I am an external consultant. So I don't feel the same weight that maybe an internal chief diversity officer or diversity manager would feel. I will always say, I think it's very difficult to change to try to change the people that sign your checks and that pay you, right? When you're entrenched deeply into a system, it's very hard to have these candid conversations with leaders and really say, this is what employees are telling me, right? But I think as an outsider, I can come in and really protect the identity of the employees that are giving this sometimes very critical feedback. And I think that it's helpful because sometimes leaders will say, oh, I had no idea that they felt like this, right? I didn't know that. And sometimes leaders will say, well, who exactly or what team, you know, because they really want to figure out who said what. But I think that having an outsider makes employees feel more comfortable and they're able to be honest and transparent. But it is very delicate, as you say, because sometimes leaders will push back and say, oh, well, this is not something we've ever heard before. Or what I see more often than not is leaders sometimes making excuses for why things are the way that they are. So I might bring something up and say, oh, well, the employees feel like they've suggested certain policy changes and these changes haven't been implemented. And leaders will say, oh, well, change takes time. Or, oh, well, you know, we did this or, oh, well, we did that, right? Rather than taking accountability and saying, you know, we could do better in this particular area. Sometimes there's deflection and there's a lack of like accountability. So I think that that's what I see very often. And that's something that anyone doing this work may struggle with, is like getting leaders to take that accountability. But I think having an outsider is easier to deliver that, because if I were inside of an organization, even as a person, you know, working within that system, it is difficult to give that feedback to leaders.
So I'm going to ask you to give me a couple of examples, without, of course, divulging, you know, anything proprietary or using names or anything like that. But first, an example of a company that you have worked with that got it right, where you went in. I mean, give us like a snippet of a case study of what the situation was and then what steps they took to move things in a more positive direction and have an outcome where the Black employees at the end of the day, as you were saying with the question, you know, do they feel safer? Do they feel more accepted, et cetera, in the workplace? Give us a success story, a snippet of one.
Yeah, I think that what I've seen is, and I didn't realize the impact of workshops and education until I was working with this one company and they had like mass layoffs recently. And so a lot of employees have either left the company voluntarily or they were laid off. And I started getting like different messages from employees who would share with me that they really, really appreciated sitting through my workshops, right? So with some of my clients, I provide consulting and I also do workshops for them. And there was one incident that happened with some employees and we did a workshop on microaggressions, right? And I do a few workshops for them every year. And so I would get messages from employees who no longer worked at that particular organization. And they were like, I really, really was transformed by that workshop, right? And it wasn't something I was expecting because I used to go into facilitating workshops with the goal of changing white people and changing the minds of white people. And I started to realize that the impact was actually making employees from these racially marginalized groups feel safer, right? Having someone that is Black, that looks like them, that's coming in and having these conversations, right? After the insurrection on January 6th, going into these companies or this company and holding space for people and really like listening to what it is that people were feeling and what sort of impact that can have and that does have on employees. And I think that one of the things that I don't see enough, Linda, is companies don't focus or disaggregate the data. They don't look at what Black employees specifically are experiencing. Black employees are often lumped in with people of color. So they'll say non-white and white employees, and they'll look at the data in that way. But they also, after facilitating a conversation or doing a listening session, there isn't often feedback that looks specifically at marginalized employees and what they're feeling post workshop, right? Or post conversation. But there was a particular situation where something happened in the company and they asked me to facilitate a workshop. I facilitated it and I received a really sweet message from someone that was involved in that incident. And they were like, that really, I'm so glad to have you here, right? And so I think that the value of being present, being an outsider from a marginalized community and being present and having these conversations, I think that value is often overlooked because the hyper focus is, how do white people feel? How do white leaders feel? Are we changing white leaders and their behavior? And I just think that there's other values to investing in DEI and bringing people in and paying someone to do this work. And I think that the value of that is often overlooked. We say, oh, we don't need to do that. We're trying to cut costs, so we're going to cut our DEI budget. But how does that make your marginalized employees actually feel to know that this is not something that the organization is prioritizing, right? So I think that for me, that is a success story when I receive those messages, because I do this work for the most vulnerable employees, right? So for those employees that don't have a voice or don't have a seat at the table, I feel like this work is for them. And so that makes me feel really good to receive those messages. And did you ask about something that hasn't worked?
Yes. Yes.
So I would say one thing that a lot of my clients are struggling with right now is employee resource groups and how to keep the momentum with employee resource groups, because these groups are often started with a particular purpose. Maybe it's to create a safe space for employees from a particular marginalized community. And then over time, the question becomes, how do we keep the momentum, right? Because you're meeting, you're having conversations. And what I'm seeing is some employees feeling like, well, what is the ultimate purpose of this group? We don't feel like we're making change. Yeah. And so why should we keep meeting, right? We don't want to continue with this group. So I think that's something that a lot of my clients are sort of struggling with, is the future of their affinity groups and their employee resource groups.
What do you think should be the goal of employee resource groups? Because I've often asked that same question with just some of the work that I've done with the various companies that, that I've interacted with. It's, they want to... they want to be inclusive. They want to be more diverse. They say they want their employees, Black and other marginalized employees, to feel that they are accepted and that they have a seat at the table and that they're valued. But at the end of the day, what does that really mean? I mean, what does that really look like in a way that that actually results in some sort of change? So what do you think mm-hmm. should be the goal of those groups?
Mm-hmm. I think most of the time those groups consist of underrepresented and marginalized employees who don't necessarily, who aren't in positions of power in the workplace. So I really think that one of the main goals of employee resource groups should be a safe space for employees from a particular community. I think that what the problem is that a lot of these groups are started with different purposes, right? Sometimes it's like to create change in the organization, to change policies, right? Or to, there's other goals. And I think that those goals might not be necessarily realistic, right? Because if you have 100 Black employees in this employee resource group and they're in junior positions in the organization, how will they be able to impact change without somebody from a position of power being able to do that, right? And I'm not an advocate for mixed employee resource groups. Some companies say, oh, we want white allies, for example. If it's a Black employee resource group, they might say, we want white allies. I don't believe in that. I think there needs to be exclusive spaces for communities. And I think that having allies or aspiring allies takes away that safety element. You can't speak candidly mm-hmm. when you have mixed companies sometimes. So I think mm-hmm. that having like really being intentional about creating that safe space. But what the one of the problems that arises is companies and organizations fearing that people will be left out or people will feel left out by making this an exclusive space for a particular community. So I've heard that where it's like, oh, well, we don't want to exclude people. And I'm like, well, what do the employees in the group want? Right. It's not what the leaders want, but it's how do they want this group to be run? So I think sometimes going into the creating the resource group without very specific and tangible goals, just kind of creating it because George Floyd happened. I think that was what was taking place is like, oh, George Floyd, we need this community. But like, what are the goals? What are the, you know, what are the objectives? What would you like for this group to accomplish? What, mm-hmm. how do the members of the employee resource group feel? Are we surveying them and taking a pulse over time? And I think that the answer is no. A lot of times it's like, well, we have this group because we know it's what we should do, but there's a lack of structure.
Yeah. Yeah. I get it. This episode is brought to you by BMW of West Houston.
Hi, this is Robert Ori, the 7-time NBA champ, also known as Big Shot Bob. BMW of West Houston has provided me and my family with the best service and the best experience for years. BMW has been there for me and my family for years, so much so that it has convinced my wife to switch over from a former brand to BMW, and she loves it. BMW has been the car to drive. It is the ultimate driving experience.
So one of the things that Black employees face, and really all employees who are non-white in marginalized communities, don't always feel as though they can bring their full selves to work in whatever sense that means. When you think about Black employees, and this is, I'm getting now to the article that you wrote, 4C Hair Discrimination. Black employees often being told that wearing their hair as it comes out of their head is not professional. Okay. So let's talk about that and tell people kind of what the point was of your article and your personal perspective and transformation as it relates to Black hair in the workplace.
Yeah. And thank you for reading that article. Again, I'm really glad that it resonated with you. But 4C Hair, for the listeners that are not familiar, is just a typing system that was developed to categorize different curly hair textures, right? And so 4C is the designation that is given to people with the tightest curl pattern, right? And the kinkiest and coarsest hair texture. And I have 4C hair. I've grown up with 4C hair. And usually I have my hair in braids or in a protective style so that I am not wearing it out. And so oftentimes employees are given very blanketed advice of like, you know, bring your full self to work and you know, allow employees to feel like they can be their authentic selves without realizing that the ways that your policies are written are not inclusive to people with different hair textures, right? I'll give you an example. I used to be a tour guide in New York City. So I worked on one of those double-decker buses. And when tourists would come in, I would show them around Manhattan. I would show them around Brooklyn. And there was a uniform we had to wear. And there was a red hat that we had to wear. And I had, the hat didn't fit my hair because I have very, very thick hair. And I decided that I was going to get my own hat that didn't have the company logo, but it was just a red hat. Right. And my manager wrote me up because she said, you're not wearing the uniform. And I explained to her, well, my hat does not fit my hair. You have a uniform, right, which is part of the company policy, but it's not inclusive to different communities of people. And it's not something that they thought about. They weren't thinking about people with curly hair and how this hat is not inclusive of that. Or what about someone who wears a hijab or a turban? That wasn't like in their mind when they created this policy. So it's nice to say we want everyone to bring their authentic selves to work, but hair discrimination is a very real issue for many Black employees. And so more conversations need to be had about the ways that this manifests, because there have been so many studies that have found that people with Afro-textured hair, people with hair that is perceived as more Black, are perceived less favorably when they're on the job market, and they're less likely to be hired. And also when their performance is being evaluated, they're rated less favorably by their peers. So that's really, really fascinating. And I feel like every month we hear about somebody being asked to cut their hair or change their hairstyle, children being asked to change their hairstyle because it's seen as inappropriate, excuse me, for school. So the article was really to bring light to this issue because, you know, the natural hair community has been booming since the 2010s. And I went natural when I moved to New York in 2012. But even within the natural hair community, there is a hierarchy that I don't think we talk enough about. And many of us with coarser hair textures have been encouraged to wear our hair in ways that are closer to whiteness and are closer to. So when you look at YouTube, right, I'm always watching YouTube to figure out my hair is very thick. How do I, what are some styles I can put in my hair? And everything is like how to do a wash and go and make your hair look like this and how to, but there isn't enough conversations on, you know, why we feel this need to tell people to change their hair in the first place and why we're not putting out information that is encouraging people to wear their hair in its natural state. That's not something I've ever done where I've literally washed my hair and walked out of the house. That is not a privilege I felt like I ever had. And so the article was really to draw attention to the fact that hair discrimination is a very real issue. But even within the quote unquote natural hair community, there is a hierarchy that doesn't prioritize people with Afro textured hair.
I haven't looked at the numbers lately, but I know it got thousands and thousands of views and likes and shares. And were you surprised that it resonated in the way that it did?
I was. It was my first time. I've written articles on hair discrimination, but I've never talked about 4C hair discrimination specifically. I don't know if I was scared or I thought it wouldn't really resonate with other people, but seeing a young TikToker who got a lot of backlash for sharing her, you know, wearing her natural hair really inspired me to write that article. Her name on TikTok is Lip Gloss, and she got, you know, her videos went viral and she was chronicling her journey to accepting her natural 4C hair and what she does and waking up and wearing it out. And I was like really inspired by that because I never did that. In my 20s, growing up, I never, you know, wore my hair in its natural state. I always felt like I had to wear it in different ways and I had to manipulate it in order for it to be acceptable. So I think seeing the younger generations really embracing their natural hair is so inspiring. But a lot of people don't know that A, hair discrimination is a thing, and they don't even understand this hair hierarchy. They don't understand what 4C hair is. And so it's really interesting because there's still a lack of education.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so interesting. Wow. I could talk to you all day, but I want to switch it up now and let you ask me some questions and before we wrap things up. So here we go.
Sure. So thank you for that opportunity. So I would love to hear, Linda, what have been your hair experiences growing up in the workplace? And did you feel that pressure to change your hair and wear your hair in ways that were seen as more professional, especially somebody who's worked in media where appearance matters a lot?
Yeah, I figured you were going to ask me that. And that's why I hadn't offered anything. I thought, I bet she's going to ask me, so I'll get a chance to talk about this. I can remember getting my first hair relaxer, which is what Black girls do, have their kinky hair straightened so that it looks more like white hair. When I was very young, I don't even remember how old I was. I was probably maybe 7, maybe 8. I remember going to the salon with my mom. And it was just kind of what I did. And then when I went to college, I wore an afro. So I wore straight natural hair for probably pretty much all 4 years. And when I think back as to why, probably one, it was just easier for me to not have to worry about, because for those of you who don't know, when you get a relaxer to straighten your naturally curly, kinky hair, you have to do that like every 6 weeks or so. Otherwise, it just goes back to being kinky. So I think about that every 6 weeks. Okay. So a lot of women dye their hair. So it's like, okay, you got to dye your hair every whatever it is. So a relaxer is a similar kind of thing. So when I was in college, I have all these pictures of me with an afro, and it was beautiful. And then I had a career as a dancer, and I'm trying to remember how my hair was when I was dancing professionally. I think probably at some point I went back to relaxing my hair, but then when I moved into media, it was expected. You know, there were, first of all, when I started on the air, there weren't as many Black women reporters and certainly not anchors when I started. And it was just expected that you would have that TV straight hair look. And so I conformed. And as you can see, I'm still conforming at the moment. But I have to say that your article really made me think long and hard about whether I want to just go back to my natural hair and just let it be what it is. And my daughter and I have been having conversations about this. She's 28 and she was like, Mom, I'm researching how to do it. And I just, because I started, you know, taking her to get hair relaxers when she was little. First, she had those little afro puffs, you know, like every little Black girl has afro puffs, right? So Lindsay had afro puffs, and then I used to braid her hair and I used to twist her hair when she was little and all of those things. And she had very long hair and very thick hair, and it was hard to manage and navigate. And I'm going to say probably around the time when she was maybe around 8 or 9, I took her to get her first relaxer. And so it's just, it's interesting, you know, because we grow up in this culture, we grow up seeing what is accepted, what is expected, and then we conform. And we don't often stop to think, or don't have the luxury of saying, I'm not going to, because does that mean I won't get that job? Would I have been hired to anchor the news if I'd had an afro? That's a really good question. And I don't know the answer to that. I'd like to think I would have been, But mm-hmm. Who knows? So
it's a struggle for me as well. I think when you grow up feeling like your hair is not enough, or not just your hair, but just some part of you is not enough or is not professional or is not fit for society, it takes many years and decades to unlearn that. So I'm still in the process of unlearning. And my husband always says to me, like, if we have a daughter, are you going to wear your hair out more? And I never really thought about that, you know, but I feel like that's something that I need to sort of learn to love and accept about myself, because I don't want to have a daughter one day and raise her to feel like her natural hair or whatever parts of her are not acceptable. So I think that that's something that many of us struggle with.
Yeah, definitely. I know one thing I've noticed on television a lot lately, just in ads and television shows in general, that we're seeing many, many more Black people with natural hair. And I love it. It's just, you know, it's just really, really wonderful to see that. So, you know, progress.
Yes, I love to see that. And representation, I was driving and I saw an ad and I told my husband, I was like, look, 4C hair. Because now I've like taught him what 4C hair is. He didn't know, you know, about that before. But I'm like, look, 4C hair. And he's like, I see that, you know, they have the billboard. So I see that a lot now.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah. Okay, so you get one more question for me and then we're going to wrap it up. Anything else?
Okay. Yes, if you could give advice to your younger self 20 years ago, what would you say to your younger self as far as just your life or your career or what you wish you knew or realized 20 years ago?
I love that question. I think the first thing that comes to mind is that I would tell myself that you're going to have some bumps along the way, but you'll get through it. You're going to be okay. And just take the next best step when you're dealing with whatever it is that comes up. You know, I've felt like I lived a charmed life up to a certain point, and then the proverbial, you know what, hit the fan. And then it was like, what is going on? And what? I don't get it. And it was really hard. And I had those moments where, you know, I wondered and where I questioned I'll just say it this way. I lost my confidence. And I would tell myself that no matter what you're going through, that you're still who you are, you're still strong, and you will get through. You just have to persevere. You just have to keep going. You can't get through something if you stop. You have to keep going to get through. And you will. So that's what I would tell myself.
I love that. I love that. I know in the moment, everything feels overwhelming, but I like to think about it in terms of, will this matter 5 years from now? And even sometimes you feel like it will and it doesn't.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. And the moments matter. You know, I have a friend, that's her favorite saying, moments matter. You know, every little moment matters. And just drink them all in. And that's how I try to live my life now. And so that's what I would tell myself. This has been so much fun.
I'm
so happy to be connected with you. And so, you know, once you're connected with me, you don't ever get rid of me. I'm just saying, okay?
That's great. You know. I love that.
So we are connected now. And if there's ever anything I can do to help amplify your voice. And we're going to link to everything that you're up to on our show notes. You have your own podcast. We will link to that. We'll make sure people know what you're doing and all the great work that you do. And thank you so much, Janice, for sharing with us today. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, Linda. I love your voice. It's so like, I want to say soothing, but it's like such a, I feel like such a commanding voice, such a television voice. So I wanted to mention that to you.
Thank you. Yeah, that TV voice is something that, I guess it's just a part of me now. So, but thank you so much, my friend. And I look forward to the next time. Take care. I mentioned Janice's podcast. It's called the Dirty Diversity Podcast. So if you're interested in what she's doing in the DEI space, that would be a good place to start. And then, of course, we'll link to everything else that she does in the show notes on ourvoicesmatterpodcast.com. Thanks so much, everybody, for giving Janice permission to speak and for having the courage to listen with an open mind. Please like, share, review, and let people know what we're doing, and then come right on back here and join us for the next episode of Our Voices Matter podcast. Take care. See you later.
Thanks again to our sponsor, BMW of West Houston. There's a special offer for members of the Our Voices Matter podcast community. Just click the link in the show notes, bmwwest.com.